You're listening to 515, the Ultra Podcast, the show that invites you into the lives of people who make up the Ultra family. Here's your host for these conversations, Larry Ryan.
Thank you, MJ. Happy New Year, listeners, and welcome to the final episode of Season 3. Today, I get to speak to two world champion women about what it takes to top the podium in your 50s and why they want to inspire others to break the records that they are setting. I thought I would end the season with a special double episode of Ohana Guest. So, you can listen to Part A now and Part B later, or cue them both up if you're having a longer training session. Part B is available now as a separate download. As the new year begins and my podcast season ends, I would like to take a second to thank you, the listeners. If you follow the Facebook or Instagram, you would have seen that this little podcast has been doing really well this year. According to Spotify, 515 is in the top 25% most shared globally by its listeners. And the reach has now grown to downloads from over 1,350 cities around the world in 68 different countries. Those numbers absolutely astound me. This has helped to increase the number of followers this past year by 118%. Finally, according to Buzzsprout, my podcast platform, 515 the Ultra Podcast is in the top 25% for downloads out of the 120,000 active podcasts hosted by them. In 2023, I hope even more listeners find their way to 515. But thank you for sharing, subscribing, and coming back for each episode. And now, today's guest. My next Ohana guest started as an NCAA All-American swimmer and just missed attending the 92 Olympics. She gave up a VP job in a Wall Street firm to become a pro triathlete. She has three Ironman titles, including the Ironman UK, where she set a course record. In Kona, she has finished in the top 10 on three occasions for the Ironman World Championship. And a few weeks ago, she topped the other Kona podium, setting a course record of 23 hours, 22 minutes, and 58 seconds for the Ultraman World Championship. Joining me from the city that was the terrestrial home of Mork from Ork, Boulder, Colorado, it is the women's Ultraman World record holder, Didi Griesbauer. Welcome.
I've actually never been introduced that way. So congratulations. That's a first, Larry. Thank you very much. I do have to correct you, however. I have left the celestial home of Mork from Ork and traveled to the East Coast for the holidays. So I am actually on Cape Cod. We drove out over the last 3 days so that we could bring our dogs. And so, yeah, we're here on the Cape to celebrate the holidays with family.
You drove through those storms?
We actually missed the storms. We were kind of wedged in between them. So we had some flurries, but not really any bad weather at all. We were very lucky. So we're going to have to time our departure to drive back home to hopefully do the same or perhaps choose a different route based on what the weather's doing. But yeah, it was an epic journey.
Well, you've been on a couple epic journeys recently for sure with that Ultraman World Championship. And I'd like to get into that in a little bit, but I'd like to start where you started with Ultraman, which is Ultraman Florida in 2020. And that outing, you actually set the world record for women with 22 hours, 48 minutes, and 31 seconds. What are your memories of Ultraman Florida, other than, you know, setting the record?
Yeah, honestly, I didn't go with the intention. I didn't know there was a world record that was up for the taking. I mean, I guess I shouldn't be surprised by that, but the first time I was aware of the record for Ultraman Florida was after day two. I had a meeting with my coach who was on my crew, and she sat me down and she said, you know, if you run, and it was a fairly like cushy run time for me. She said, if you run like 10 hours, 35 or whatever it was, she's like, you'll break the world record for Ultraman. And I looked at her and I was like, number one, I didn't know there was a world record. Number two, why would you tell me that? yeah. too much pressure going into day three, even though that's like I had a fair amount of cushioning and thought I could run, you know, faster than 10:35 or whatever it was. But I was like, I just didn't want that kind of pressure. Honestly, I tried to finagle my way into the Ultraman World Championship without qualifying. I had emailed race organizers and was like, hey, here's my Ironman resume. Do you think maybe? And they're like, nope, we'd love to have you qualify at any of our qualifying events. And honestly, I'm so appreciative that they didn't just let me in because I learned so much at Ultraman Florida that helped so much for the Ultraman World Championship. So having that Ultraman Florida experience, and I'm going to sound like a donkey when I say it, but I mean, I broke the world record, but I made so many mistakes. Like I made so many errors and had so much to learn and sort of clean up about my preparation, particularly my nutrition and my overall strategy, that I was glad to have the Ultraman Florida experience. Plus I got to become part of the Ultraman Ohana, right? So I just got that much more excited when the opportunity came around to race the Ultraman World Championship, because a lot of my Ultraman Florida family was in Hawaii, either crewing or competing themselves. And so it was like a great reunion. And so it was really special. Yeah. I loved Florida. It was a great experience.
Yeah. And no matter how many of those Ironman races you have, they don't really prepare you for that Ultraman. You need to have that experience to dial in nutrition and rest and all those other things that happen on an Ultraman course.
Yeah, particularly the fueling, because I thought my strategy for Ultraman Florida was to go in and repeat my Ironman fueling strategy 3 days in a row. And I found out very early on in day two that that was a poor strategy. And thankfully, my crew for Florida included Jordan Bryden, who had won Ultraman Canada in 2019 and had then won the Ultraman World Championship in 2019. He's one of my training partners and he was on my crew and he just triaged. He drove the van to the nearest convenience store and bought anything and everything that might be useful nutritionally. And started handing me stuff. He's like, try this. I was like, nope. He's like, try that. I'm like, maybe. Okay, we'll stick with that for a little while and then we'll try something else. Like it was, thank goodness for Jordan at Ultraman Florida, because he really did help to solve that problem, because I really didn't have a backup plan. And it just goes to show there's so much learning that has to be done. So I was grateful for the Ultraman Florida experience.
Mm-hmm. And you ended up setting every record like for each of the segments there, except for the run, I guess, because you had that cushion. Otherwise, you would have pushed yourself to get that one too. But you weren't even aware of them. So
I think had I pushed myself, I might have actually done more harm than good. The run is where I really I struggled the most at Ultraman Florida, despite having some nutritional problems on day two on the bike. I was still able to bike reasonably well, but by day three, I got through the first marathon pretty well, but I had some pretty bad GI issues during the second marathon that definitely slowed me down. So again, appreciative because my plan was after Ultraman Florida to race Ultraman Worlds in 2020, but 2 weeks after we got back from Ultraman Florida, the world changed forever.
Right.
And so we went into a 2-year postponement of the Ultraman World Championship, which ultimately just gave me that much more time to get stronger and smarter and better with my Ultraman planning. So it was always just such a blessing that I didn't realize at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I met Jordan at Ultraman Canada and he's been on the show as well, but he described nutrition as the fourth discipline for Ultraman.
Absolutely. And I, for me, even in my Ironman racing, nutrition has been a bit of an Achilles heel for me. So it's been something that, given my experience at Ultraman Florida, I really doubled down and changed nutrition sponsors and started working with a new nutritionist. I've worked with several nutritionists across both of my careers, both as a swimmer and as a triathlete. And no one really quite stuck. And then I was introduced to my current nutritionist and we just hit it off really well. And he made things really simple and wasn't trying to recreate me as a human being and change my habits, was just trying to find little things to change that yielded huge differences. And over the course of the couple of years we've been working together, it's paid massive dividends in my fueling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, clearly. you got that dialed in now. So going back to your swimming days then, as a high schooler, you were setting some national prep school records. You were captain of your team that won NCAA championship. You've won a gold medal at the Pan Am Games for people on this side of the world. And then you just missed going to the Olympics. What events did you compete in for the trials and how close were you?
In the trials, I competed in the 100 and 200 meter backstroke. I had also qualified in the 400 IM, but I didn't compete because the probability of my making the team was relatively low in that. And so we wanted to save our bullets, so to speak, for my best races. I was fifth in the 200 backstroke, which, you know, in the US, they take top two. My time from the Olympic trials would have finaled at the Olympic Games that summer. That's just how competitive the US
team. That's how strong the US is in swimming, yeah.
It's how deep the US team is. Ultimately, I think I missed it by a couple of tenths of a second, which might as well be a country mile in swimming. Like, that's a long way in swimming. Like, that's a visible distance. But yeah, when you say it to people that don't know swimming that well, it's like, yeah, it was a couple tenths of a second off, you know, being an Olympian. And they're like, oh my God. I'm like, I was fifth. Like, there were people between me and the team. You know, it was close enough that I'll say going into that Olympic trials, and I competed in two Olympic trials. I competed in 88, but it was just experience at the Olympic trials, which I'm glad I had going into 92. I think going into 92, nobody would have called me a favorite, but had I made the team, I don't think anybody would have necessarily been surprised. I'd been on the US national team since 1989. As to your point, I had competed internationally both at the Pan American Games and the Pan Pacific Games and won both of those events. I'd been to the Goodwill Games, which is now, I don't think actually even exists anymore, but I had been on several national teams. And so my name was known. I was in there as a possibility, but at the end of the day, I just didn't have, I think in large part, if I look back on it, due to fueling, I just didn't have my best swim on that day. And you need to, given how competitive, you know, it is to make a US Olympic team.
Right. Yeah. Well, now that they have marathon swimming at the Olympics, and you know, like you got a pretty good 10K time there. If you could knock off a 20 minutes, you know, if you don't have another 500 kilometers to go after the swim, maybe you can knock off that 20 minutes and get in the Olympics now with the marathon swim.
With the marathon swim. Although I do look at some of the US marathon swimmers, the long distance swimmers swimming 5 and 10K, and a lot of them are doubling. They're pool swimmers in the mile, and then they do the 5 and 10K open water. And I certainly don't have that kind of speed. I'm 52 years old. I can't compete against 17-year-olds. I mean, I guess I could try, but it would take a little bit. And plus the strategy for open water swimming in the Olympics, they really do. Like they swim in a pack, and it's the last, you know, 200 meters they absolutely sprint to get their hand on the board. Right. So it's a different animal altogether, but it's good to have goals. So I'll have to add that one to the list.
Talk to your coaches, see what they think.
Be like, are you crazy?
So you eventually make your switch from swimming to triathlon. How does that happen? What brings you to triathlon?
I actually retired from swimming in 1994. I had finished college in 92 and swam for a couple of years post-collegiately, which was highly unusual at the time. There wasn't a big post-collegiate, there wasn't a support system for athletes to swim post-collegiately. But when I finished my senior year at Stanford, I had swum best times. I was still loving what I was doing. And I saw no reason to quit. So I did swim for two more years, but I didn't make the world championship team in 94. And I just felt like I was kind of falling behind my peers, professionally speaking. My parents were like, you need to go out and get a job. So I went out and got a job and applied to business school and got my MBA at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and then went to work on Wall Street. So I actually took a little bit of a break from being sort of an athlete. I stayed active and I ran a couple of marathons just because I found running to be a really efficient way to stay fit. Mm-hmm. And I always liked having a goal. So probably once or twice a year, I'd find a marathon 6 or 8 months down the road and train not particularly wisely. Like I wasn't doing any speed work or even really any tempo runs. I would just go out and every once in a while do a long run and then line up for a marathon. And my results showed it. I mean, I think I ran in the time between being a swimmer and being a triathlete, I think I ran somewhere around 10 marathons, and all of them were within 4 minutes of each other in terms of time.
Wow.
I never got any better, but I also didn't get much worse. I had a tremendously robust aerobic engine from all the years of swimming, but having never done any speed work or tempo work, I just wasn't getting any faster. And it wasn't until I actually started working with my very first triathlon coach. I had one more marathon on the schedule when I started working with her, and she had me hit go on the track and do tempo runs. And I went into that marathon and ran something like a, I don't know, 28 minute PR, and was like, wow, look at what that does. So yeah, I was introduced to the Ironman though. I think like a lot of people watching it on TV, I was in business school and I should have been studying for finals, but I was just kind of burnt out. And I turned on the TV and the Ironman happened to be on. And I watched Karen Smyers run down a failing Paula Newby Fraser and just was like, literally with the like popcorn, like shoveling it in my, I was like, what's going to happen next? It was so exciting. And my coaches had always told me, even as a swimmer, that, you know, you get better as the distance gets longer. And it was a crying shame as a backstroker that there wasn't a mile backstroke, because I think honestly that might have been my event. So I saw it on TV and I just sort of had this thing. I wanted to do it. I wanted to see if I could do it. I had run my very first marathon while I was in business school. And the summer before business school, I had ridden my bike across the country with a boy that I was trying to impress. So he was planning to ride his bike across the country and he's like, do you want to come? And I was like, okay. I bought a bike and 5 days later we flew to Seattle and started riding back to the East Coast.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So the boy ended up being not that impressive, so that was ill-fated, but we did finish the trip. And so when I saw the Ironman on TV, I was like, well, I swam in college, I did the bike trip, I know I can bike a long way, and I've run my first marathon, so let's see if I could do this thing. And so I signed up for an Ironman the summer after business school before I started my job on Wall Street. It was a great sort of outlet. I had 3 months off before I had to start my job. And I just said, I'm going to get as fit as I can and see how it goes. And I loved the experience. I raced Vine Man out in California when it was a full distance Ironman. And I loved it. But I went to work on Wall Street. I was living in Manhattan and I was like, it was sort of a one and done bucket list, scratch it off. And it wasn't until a couple of years later, I met my husband, we'd gotten married. And I said to him, I remember so distinctly, I was like, I kind of want to try another Ironman, you know, before we start a family and things get crazy. And I ended up signing up for Ironman Florida and I qualified for the Ironman World Championship. And I was like, well, going to the Ironman World Championship sounds like a lot more fun than having a kid. So let's do that. It was at that point that I hired a coach because I thought I really needed some help because I wasn't super well prepared for Ironman Florida. I relied on the aerobic engine that I had. And I ended up being introduced to Karen Smyers. I was living in Boston at the time and she lives outside of Boston. And so she agreed to coach me and I raced 2 more years as an amateur. And it was at her urging that I quit my job and start racing professionally. So yeah, I lit up at the idea of being a professional athlete. I think sport has been such a big part of my life, you know, growing up as a swimmer, and it's just something I can relate to. So when the opportunity presented itself again, I had to try, and my husband was incredibly supportive. Neither one of us envisioned that my career would last for 20 years. But here we are.
Now, and just getting stronger.
Well, yeah, in a lot of ways, I feel like I am. I'm getting smarter, and I am getting stronger. So it's exciting. It's exciting. I think I worry a little less about what others might think. And I think that's been very liberating, that I'm willing to do things and take chances. Because at this point I have nothing left to prove, really, except to see for myself what is possible. And it's been really, really exciting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you said at your Ultraman Florida speech that you gave up an underworking overpaid job for an overworking underpaid job to become a pro triathlete. But that's obviously the best thing that you've ever done.
100%. I mean, every once in a while when I look at our bank account, I'm like, yeah, maybe that was a questionable choice. But I would say that I'm a lot happier. I think as a family, we're healthier because of it. I think our lives are more balanced. I mean, my husband still has a very stressful sort of corporate job, in financial services. And so we live that, but through my involvement with Ultraman, I think he's more active and more fit. And I think that aspect of my job and my career just keeps us really well balanced in a way. I really have no regrets. I mean, it'd be nicer to have a little more money, I'm not going to lie, but I think we're happier and healthier for it.
Yeah. Partway through your career, you actually had a very serious crash as well. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I understand it was potentially a career-ending injury in the triathlon. And then you would have had to go back to Wall Street.
I don't have to go back to Wall Street and make all that darn money. So it was 2011, I believe. I went over to race the European Championship in Frankfurt, and I traveled over to Germany by myself and got into the race. Didn't have a great swim, but I was on the bike and sort of moving up. And it started to rain a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit. And we were in one of the small villages. So the Frankfurt course, sort of at the outskirts, you break out from the city and then you go through. It's kind of a cool course because you're out at sort of in this almost rural setting. And then all of a sudden you're in this village, this town. And in the town, there's a series of sort of almost every town, there's a series of these roundabouts. And so I was in one of the towns headed into a roundabout. And what I didn't realize is that the roundabout was lined with cobblestone. And so I was cornering to enter the roundabout and realized, oh my gosh, I am cornering on wet cobblestone. And as soon as I saw it, my wheels flipped up to the right, and I just slammed down on the pavement on the left. And I mean, I was going, according to my Garmin, about 20.4 miles an hour around the roundabout. And so the doctors told me that ultimately this ended up being a good thing, which when you hear the list of my injuries, I was like, that's good. I sort of skidded along the pavement like a pebble on a lake, right? So I was like, you know, boom, 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 as I skidded at high velocity across the pavement. I lost consciousness. I was airlifted to a trauma ICU in Frankfurt and spent 3 or 4 days in the ICU. I broke 2 ribs. I broke my elbow, which is fine. But I broke my pelvis in 2 places and I broke my hip. And so I wasn't actually aware of all of this while I was in Frankfurt. I knew about the elbow and I suspected the ribs, but they hadn't done any imaging on my pelvis. And it wasn't until they wanted to move me from the ICU to general ward. And again, I'm by myself in Germany. My last name is Griesbauer. So everyone's speaking to me in German. Like I understand what's going on. And I was like, I just need to get out of here. And an old friend from professional racing, Katja Schumacher, a retired pro, she lives in Heidelberg outside of Frankfurt. And she actually saw my crash on TV because they broadcast the race live. Mm-hmm. And she and I we did a couple of training camps together and we're good friends. And she came up to Frankfurt, and thank goodness for that, because she was sort of able to help me navigate the medical system and like get me released. And I stayed with her for a night or two while we sorted my flights home. Mm-hmm. She was a huge help. So I flew home with all of these broken bones, not really realizing that my pelvis and my hip were completely, broken. Wow. And it wasn't until I got home, I just happened to message my doctor. We were living in Boston at the time. And I happened to message my doctor and I was like, hey, just so you know, you might be getting some medical records from a hospital in Germany. I had a bike crash and, I broke my elbow and a couple of ribs. But I've flown home and I'm fine. I'm still a little sore. She's like, you laid in an ICU for 4 days and then got on a transatlantic flight. She's like, get your butt in here right now. Cause she was worried about blood clots.
Right.
So I went in for imaging of my chest, to look for clots in my lungs. And then she did, I think they did, some tests on my circulatory system. And that's when I started complaining about my hip. And they basically put me in an MRI tube and scanned my entire body to see exactly what was going on. And that's where, they discovered the fractured pelvis and hip. I was fortunate in that none of the fractures were displaced. But where I fractured my hip, I went to see an orthopedic trauma specialist in Boston. And one great thing about Boston is there's a lot of really good doctors and hospitals. And I went to see an orthopedic trauma specialist and he looked at my scans and he said, you're going to heal and you're going to be fine, but I don't think you'll ever run again. Mm-hmm. Not the way that you need to be a professional athlete doing what you want to do.
Right.
Immediate devastation, right? And so I walked out of there doomsday scenarios, like I've got to clean up my resume, I've got to find a job. And my husband was like, wait a minute. He's like, he's one doctor in a city of a gazillion orthopedic specialists. So we went and we saw another one and he disagreed completely. He's like, this is not a career-ending injury. He's like, it's a non-displaced fracture. He's like, you need to be really careful and you need to manage your rehabilitation. You need to do a lot of PT, but you're going to be fine. So my husband's like, let's listen to him. So we did. And I went through the whole PT process, but I rushed it. I was stupid. I rushed it. Mm. And I was anxious to get back out racing. And I came back too soon and ended up with a stress fracture in my sacrum because I still was tremendously imbalanced and I didn't have the symmetry to go back to doing what I had been doing. And it really did slow me down. And I had a series of sort of follow-on injuries because I had rushed the rehabilitation, but ultimately I did make it back to racing. Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously with swim, bike, and run, anything with the hips is going to be major downfall for you. Have you now gone through everything that you need to where you're super strong again and everything's balanced, or do you still have like a niggle here and there, or you get into some cold weather and you feel it? How is it now?
No, I feel entirely healthy now. I still have a weird like lump where I landed on my hip. I call it my saddlebag because it kind of like it just makes my hip protrude a little bit in that spot, but it doesn't give me any problems. I don't have more pronounced injury patterns on one side versus the other. For a great number of years now, I've been pretty even. I spend a lot of time in the gym, and that's both a function of, I think, just trying to build a stronger, more robust athlete, but also as injury prevention. And of course my age, I think as we get older as athletes, I think that gym work becomes more and more important. And so I'm super dedicated to my gym work. I have a great strength coach and she does a wonderful job of feeding me what I need to stay strong and still be getting faster at my age.
Who's your coach? Who's your strength coach?
Her name is Kate Ligler.
We're going to make sure that she gets her props on the
Yeah, give her a shout out. Kato Strong on Instagram. She's she doesn't do a lot of Instagramming. She's not really into it, but yeah. She is a wonderful strength coach and it's been great, great working with her. She's a pro cyclist in her own right. And so she knows our sport. She works with a lot of triathletes as well. And she does a great job.
Good. So you raced your first Ironman at the age of 26 and now 26 years later, you've become the world champion at the Ultraman distance. As I said, you set a course record when you did it. You broke the record by more than 45 minutes. You won the women's race by an hour and 45 minutes. And you finished third overall for the race. What was it like to take that title at the Ultraman World Championship for you?
Oh gosh, it was. I still don't think I've processed it fully. I think that's actually going to take a while, but it was. I've been an athlete for nearly my entire life, right? I'm 52 years old. I started swimming when I was 4. Mm-hmm. I started swimming competitively when I was 6. I took a little hiatus in the middle there when I was working on Wall Street, but I was still running marathons and I've been a professional triathlete. Well, I've been a triathlete for 20 years. So I've been around sport an awful long time and I know enough to know that even with the most thorough of preparations, that oftentimes you get out there on race day and you just don't get the day you deserve.
Yeah.
So when we got out there to Ultraman and we got through day one and had a great day and we got through day two and had another great day and things were going really, really well. We didn't have mechanical issues. My body was holding up. I was, you know, my stomach felt great. Like everything was going well. So there was some pressure going into day three. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, most people would look at, I think going into day three, I had a 2-hour and 6-minute lead on second place.
Right.
And most people would pat themselves on the back and be like, yeah, I'm a world champion. I just got to just jog, you know, halfway around the Big Island of Hawaii to get to the finish line. And this is a done deal. But I was very respectful of what needed to be done on day three. And really, until I saw that finish line, didn't let myself comprehend that I had the kind of performance at the Ultraman World Championship that reflected the preparation that I put in. And I'm just so grateful for that because it doesn't always happen that way. I take my sport very seriously. I do treat it as a job and a very serious job. And I try to go into every race absolutely prepared, but you don't always get what you deserve. And so the Ultraman World Championship was just a really special experience where I got exactly what I deserved. And my crew was amazing. They took their job seriously. I had other athletes reach out to me and be like, could your crew put on a training camp for my crew? Because you guys were like next level crew. And they really, really were. And part of it was that some of them had been my crew at Ultraman Florida as well. So they had crew experience.
Right. Can you name your crew for me? Who are these people that did such a great job?
My husband, Dave Griesbauer, my coach, Julie Dibbins, my strength coach, Kate Ligler, my training partner, Laura Siddle, and my massage therapist, Sophie Evans, who is also an Ironman athlete and an ultra runner as well. So it was funny
it's a stacked crew.
It's a stacked crew, but because the race takes place at Thanksgiving, it's hard to find crew because most people are spending time with families. And so my crew was a Canadian, 2 Brits, my husband, who was dragged along with me anyway, and Kate Ligler, who was like, I don't care about Thanksgiving. Let's go. So it worked out really, really well that they were all people who know me incredibly well because I work with them day in and day out. I mean, nobody knows you better than your training partners, your coach, your spouse, you know, your massage therapist. It may as well be like a therapy session when you're on the massage table. You're just yammering about, you know, everything. And so these people know me really, really well, and we're super invested in the performance as well. And it just showed that their execution was what made the performance come as easily as it did. And I'm not saying it was easy, but we were well prepared and we executed the snot out of that race. Like my whole crew just really executed across those 3 days. And so it just was a feeling of, I mean, gratitude, celebratory. I mean, after 52 years of life, I can finally stand up and say I'm a world champion. It's unreal. Like it still doesn't feel real. It's extraordinary. It's amazing. It's great.
And it was in a very stacked field of women athletes as well. You know, I was talking with Steve King for the preview show, and he was saying this is probably the best field that's ever been assembled there, both on the men's and the women's side, but particularly on the women's side. And what did you think about when you looked at who you were going up against before the race?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely motivated me every single day in training, right? I mean, I was going up against Tara Norton, who's a two-time Ultraman world champion. She had more experience than any of us on that course and with this event. And full respect to her resume, she's been a tremendous Ironman athlete as well, super strong all around. Leanne DeCave, who made it quite public, she was going for her fifth world title. She's won, she's got four world titles on her resume. I had none. So we're going up against a four-time world champion, right? I'm like, well, let's see, four world championships and I've got nothing. Okay, great. That seems good. So again, great motivator. And then I was aware of Antonina Resnikoff. I know she went into Ultraman Florida trying to get my world record at that event. She didn't come away with it, but if you're talking, you know, world records, she had to have, she hasn't raced a ton, so there wasn't a bunch of information on her, but I knew she'd be tough. And then, I mean, there's just the whole field, you never know what's going to show up for you on race day. So I knew the potential in the women's race was very, very strong. But when you get to the actual execution of the race, I just prepared the absolute best I could. And I was very lucky to show up healthy and very lucky that we executed across, you know, 3 days and it worked out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it was a great field. It was a hugely talented field. And that was an inspiration day in and day out in my preparation.
Yeah. And when I was looking at the times, you were like third out of the water at 2:49.53, which I understand was just a terrible swim for a lot of people that were behind you. And you were second overall at the end of day one and 14 seconds behind Rob Gray. So, and he came out of the water around the same time as you. You must have spent the most of the day with Rob Gray. Is that what happened out there on the bike?
Yeah. So I came out of the swim and looked at the time and thought, oh, dear Lord, that's just dreadful. I was hoping for in and around 2.5 hours, but the conditions on the day were, they weren't favorable. And thankfully for the people at the front of the race who were, you know, relatively strong swimmers, I mean, it was still tough, but we got through it. I felt for the people that, I mean, there were people in there for 5 and very close to 6 hours near the cutoff. And I just thought, oh dear gosh, I couldn't fathom being in the water for that long. So credit to those that persevered and carried on. I came out of the water. I wasn't really concerned about Rob, to be honest. We came out of transition almost together. I think he was a little bit behind me and immediately shot past me. But on the climb up to Captain Cook, I kind of went back by him and we exchanged. He lives in Boulder. I know who he is. We've done a ride together a few years ago, but I don't know him well. But we exchanged kind of pleasantries. And for the first, I'm going to say 20 miles, we were back and forth a little bit. And then as we got towards Ocean View, I think I hadn't seen him for quite a while. And I was in front of him at that point. I hadn't seen him for quite a while. But when we turned and started the descent down into South Point, he went flying by me on the descent. And he's a monster descender, like just so confident and poised. And I was like, okay, be careful, be careful, be careful. So he put, I think he was at that point, probably 2 to 3 minutes in front of me. Like I would still occasionally see his crew. So our crews would see each other quite a bit.
Right.
I hadn't seen him cause he was behind me. So I think he was maybe a minute or two behind me for a while. And then he overtook the lead on the descent and was a couple of minutes in front of me, but I did continue to see his crew. And it wasn't until probably 15 miles left on the climb up to Volcano that I would start to sort of catch glimpses of him on the climb on some of the straighter sections. But again, right. I wasn't focused on Rob. Rob wasn't focused on me. He knew who he was competing against. I knew who I was competing against. He laughs and tells the story. In retrospect, he works with Matt Bottrell as one of his coaches or advisors. And our squad works quite a bit with Matt Bottrell, advising on aerodynamics and some cycling specific stuff. And so my coach Julie told me that as soon as day one ended, Rob Gray was texting Matt Bottrell being like, dude, she's not human. He kept looking over his shoulder at me and tells the story afterwards. He's like, I was doing VO2 max efforts to try to drop her and she just kept staying there. Again, my focus wasn't on Rob, but we had a great sort of camaraderie. After I crossed the line, I went over straight over to congratulate him because we did spend a lot of time in proximity to one another and with our crews back and forth. So was there a lot of communication back and forth, mostly amongst the crews to him and, you know, his crew to me. And I went over and I was like, massive day, man, like great riding. And he looks at me, he's like, you nearly broke me out there. He's like, I'm not sure I want to congratulate you. And we took a couple photos together. It was funny. I was day two when he went down. I didn't see it happen, but I saw it very shortly after. He was on the ground and like there was a motorist like checking his helmet, not like perceivably for cracks and like head brain injuries. And I actually felt like I was going to throw up when I saw it. And I put in such a surge to get to his crew, who I knew was up front.
Oh yeah.
And so I literally put in an effort and it ended up being like a half a mile. I saw his crew and I'm screaming like a crazy person, like, Rob went down. You have to go back. Rob went down. And it was, I'm so glad he's okay. You know, there's such a camaraderie amongst the athletes at Ultraman and you don't like to see another competitor go down. Thankfully he was okay. And he actually came out on day three to sort of cheer a little bit for the athletes, which I had so much respect for him. So he'll be back. I mean, he was great for me because again, he had experience on that course. And so a couple of times I saw him on day three and I was asking for bits of advice as I was in the middle of the race and he's kind of looking at me like, what is with this girl? But he's full respect to Rob, and I hope he comes back. I know he was gunning for the win there, and I hope he gets it. I hope he comes back next year and gets it.
Yeah, and I know the other athlete that went down as well, Barry Berg, is like right here in my backyard in Vancouver, and I was talking with him about, oh, you know, how's the recovery going? And he hadn't left Hawaii yet. Like he ended up staying there for a couple of weeks. Same as like with you, you can't really fly given some of those injuries. And hopefully by now Barry's feeling better.
Yeah, I think he had said at awards, he did come to awards. I did not see, he was a little bit behind me when he had his accident on day two and was much more severely injured, obviously, than Rob. I think he had a partially collapsed lung, which again, you can't fly with that. Yeah. So he had said at awards that he was going to be, you know, and it is like, everyone's like, oh, Crimea River, you're stuck in Hawaii, but you want to get home after something like that. You know, you don't want to be there. You want to be home with your family and your support network. So, you know, my heart goes out to him and I hope he has by this point made it home. I think mid-December he said he was going to be able to get home. So I hope he has made it home by now. Yeah.
So by the time you get to the end of this race, you do that run and you're getting your advice. You get another PR for the run over Florida, like 26 minutes faster than Florida was. And as I said, you've set, you know, some records along the way, but I think the one that maybe is the most impressive is your age group record, that you set for the Ultraman World Championship, because previously it was set by Kimi Rouse in 2009 at 28 hours and 53 minutes for the 50 to 59. And yours was 23:22:58. So 5.5 hours off the time. Like, were you aware of that record? And like, how does it feel when you can even comprehend that you're able to break a record by 5.5 hours?
That honestly, that's the first time I'm hearing of it. And it is, I mean, it's, I mean, Kim Rouse is, she's legendary, right? I mean, she's awesome. So I hadn't heard that. That is the first time I've heard that. You know, people, it is my pet peeve, and I've said this before, when people say that age is just a number. And I'm like, that is such a lie, because age is a really real thing. I was like, obviously the people that say that age is just a number are like 24 years old. They don't know. They haven't seen me get out of bed in the morning to say that age is just a number. Age is really real. But I hope what I'm proving is that we can still be successful in spite of our age. So while to learn that I broke the age group record at Ultraman Worlds by 5.5 hours, I hope I'm proving to people and to particularly to women, I hope that record gets broken. I hope someone takes the torch and says, I can do this. I'm 50, whatever years old, and I can still do this and be successful. So I hope I hold it for a little while, because that's kind of nice to know. But I hope that someone breaks it, because I think older athletes, masters athletes around the globe are proving that we can get better in spite of the fact that we're older. And that's really, that's what's motivating me to keep going as a professional. I'm the oldest professional triathlete on the planet. Cameron Brown's close behind me down in New Zealand, but I'm going to keep going until he stops. Cameron, if you're in, I'm in.
one more record, huh?
Yeah, just one more. Yeah, one more thing to sort of hold on to. So yeah. He inspires me. I mean, again, all of these women who are in their 40s and 50s and doing incredible things, they're inspiring to me. So I hope I can provide some inspiration to women, not even to go out and do Ultraman, but just to say, just because you're however old you are, doesn't mean you can't get better. And it is possible.
Mm-hmm. And for you, I assume it's those hours of training. It's the coaching you're getting now that has brought you to this level to keep you strong enough to keep doing it. And you've also started to branch out a little bit because, as you said, you know, you're not making your Wall Street dollars anymore. So you got to get a little side hustle going. You've done a couple different things. One of them is coaching with your crew. Maybe tell us a little bit about how you ended up getting involved in the coaching side. Obviously, it's because you're hanging out with your friends all the time. But what is it that drew you to try and do some coaching on the side as well?
My first coaching client, it happened relatively early in my professional career. She was my next door neighbor. We lived in the same brownstone in Boston, and she had signed up for Ironman Coeur d'Alene. And she was like, "Will you coach me?" And I was like, "Jen, I don't coach." I'm like, "I don't know the first thing about coaching. Like, I wouldn't know what to do." She's like, "Well, you know more than I do." And I was like, all right. So I wrote a program for her, and she finished Ironman Coeur d'Alene, which was her goal. And she was thrilled. And little by little, just by word of mouth, word started getting out, and I started coaching more and more people and getting a little bit more confident in it. It's only been the last couple of years I've started coaching for the JD crew and under Julie Dibbins' coaching umbrella. And I actually, you know, I had a pretty full roster of athletes, but I approached Julie and said, "Hey, could I be a part of this?" Because what we've got going with the JD crew is really cooperative. I mean, I have my roster of athletes that I coach, but we have biweekly meetings with all of our coaches and give updates on our athletes and bounce ideas off of each other. "Hey, I have this athlete who's battling this issue and we can't seem to figure it out and break through it. You know, what do you guys think?" And so it's made me a smarter coach. Mm-hmm. And I think it's helped my athletes as a result. Plus there's the community, right? The camps and the social things at races, et cetera, et cetera, that is also beneficial and fun for the athletes. But for me, selfishly, being mentored by Julie as a coach has made me a more thoughtful coach. So it's been a great opportunity.
And what do you think it is about that Colorado area that draws so many triathletes? Like, I don't think, maybe you can tell me, do the athletes come to Colorado or are they born out of Colorado? Like,
Colorado is a terrible place to race and train. Nobody should move there. No, I'm just kidding. It's getting overrun with triathletes. We want to keep it a secret. Honestly, there's great roads for riding. There's great trails for running. There are all of the things that make a training environment good. It's beautiful. It's close to the Denver airport. It's in the middle of the country, so it's easy to get to races on either side. It's, you know, there's so many things about it, but I think it's not just triathlon. It's running, it's rock climbing, it's cycling. And so there's also the community of people who support us as athletes, strength coaches, PTs, massage therapists, sports psychologists. The best of the best are there. And it really has, I didn't realize this at the time, we moved to Boulder from Boston when I joined. I was working with Siri Lindley and she moved her training base to Boulder. And my husband ended up randomly with a job opportunity in Boulder. And so we're like, yeah, Boulder would be fun. And again, we moved there thinking it'd be, you know, a few years. He's settled into a great job there and is like very successful in his career. And for me, it's being in Boulder. I think if I was still in Boston, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing because there isn't the community there to support it in the same way at the professional level. So it's really prolonged my career. There's great swim squads. There's great masters. You know, the things that triathletes need to be successful, and athletes in general, endurance or any kind of outdoorsy sport, the resources are there to keep you healthy and keep going.
Right. I was in Boulder this summer on a big road trip tour, and I thought it was just a great little town. It's definitely one I'd like to go back to. Like, it does have that small town feel to it, even though you're right next to Denver. But yeah, so I can see how that would be an attraction for a lot of people.
Yeah, we love it there. We're super happy. Yeah, I don't see us going anywhere anytime soon.
And of course, the other side hustle that you've picked up on is doing commentary with Ironman. How long have you been doing that broadcasting now with Ironman?
Well, Ironman, I think I had done one world championship event. They brought me on as part of their commentary team to add a female voice. They didn't really have a regular female voice. And so they invited me to join the commentary team for 70.3 Worlds. I think it was in 2016 or 17. Mm-hmm. And I was so nervous. I literally sat there at the comment in the booth with the guys that I was with, you know, I think I was with Matt Lieto and Michael Lovato. And anytime I had something to say, I literally put my hand up and they were like, okay, this is a different way to go about it. I was so nervous. And it was in 2018, actually, that Ironman signed the agreement with Facebook where they're going to start broadcasting these races live on Facebook Watch. And so they were going to be doing a lot more races. It wasn't just the world championship and the championship events that they were going to be covering. They were going to be covering a lot of races, which is great for the sport, right? Mm-hmm. We're like showing these professionals and telling their stories and making Ironman. I mean, it's not a spectator friendly event, but there's diehard fans and the races are exciting the way that they unfold. And so being able to bring these races to people all over the world was just, it was so exciting. And they asked if I wanted to be a part of it. And I leapt at the opportunity and I love our team and it's such a great opportunity. And I'm so thankful to be a part of it.
How do they decide who does what job? Who's on the course? Who's in the studio? You know, like.
I don't know. They've never sent me out on the course. I don't, which is fine. Cause I would probably fall off the back of the moto if I'm being honest. Maybe they just figure I'm better sitting in a chair in the studio. It's safer. I don't know. I have great rapport with our entire team. So we do swap out oftentimes. They'll put Greg Welch down sort of at the hot corner of whatever race we're broadcasting, and Lieto they tend to put as our man on the street. They just don't want to call me the woman on the street because it would be controversial. for now I'm in the booth, but no matter who's beside me in the booth, you know, we have a great rapport. We have a fantastic team. Yeah. Not only our team of commentators, but the whole team at Ironman that supports us and our team at BCC, in studio, they're great. And again, it's been educational for me. And it's in a lot of ways made me a better athlete, because the things that even in my long career, the things that I haven't experienced myself, I've now watched as a commentator. I have a front row seat to the best in our sport executing their craft. And I get to study it and talk about it with other people that have been around in the sport for a long time. And it's made me smarter. And I'm just, at the end of the day, I am the biggest triathlon nerd. Like, I'm just a fan of the sport. And so I love being able to tell these stories, and I get really excited to sit on the mic and commentate races. I just love it.
So have you got to the point now where when you're like, I was watching the world championship and, you know, you guys started right off at body marking and I saw Jane Bocas there, right front and center for the body marking. But are you able to now, like if they do a pre-interview, are you able to tell the athletes like, oh, that they're nervous right now, or maybe there's something they're not saying? Like, have you got to that point where you're able to read the athletes a little bit better now?
I think everyone tries to put on their best poker face, but you can, like, we definitely comment when we're off mic about, wow, they looked really, really nervous. Some people just wear their nerves in different ways. I don't think it's necessarily telling of the performance that they're able to have, but I think you do start to notice things about, you know, when athletes go quiet on social media, there's speculation they must be injured. Like, it's, you know, it's... Mm. we try to do our homework as to what's what, because it adds to the stories that we tell. But I don't think it's just so hard to predict, right? I don't think anybody would have predicted. I mean, certainly people were predicting Norway, Team Norway for the Norwegians for the men's side. But I don't think anybody would have given Sam Laidlaw the time of day. And the fact that he put out the performance he did was just so exciting. And we're sitting in the booth, like at the edge of our seats, like, oh my God, he's doing it. And the same with Chelsea Sodaro. I mean, I don't think anybody would have been shocked to see her in the top 10. I don't think anybody picked her to win. And the fact that she, you know, was able to hold on, you know, we get to share that, and the excitement that we feel, I hope we impart to the people watching along. It's spectacular.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I was watching you pronouncing all those Hawaiian names so well. Is that because you spend the time to practice those, or you just heard them so many times over the years? How long does it take for you to prepare for one of these races? Like maybe just that last World Championship. How many hours are you putting into your prep?
I'm a studier. I like to be prepared. I think some of my co-commentators feel more comfortable sort of, I don't want to say winging it, but they like to experience a lot of things sort of firsthand as the race unfolds.
Right.
But I study. I go through the entire field. I read all of the notes, and, you know, out of respect, our whole team goes through coaching for how to pronounce those Hawaiian words out of respect for our host community, because to mispronounce them is not respectful. So we try to study and do it right. The same goes with the pronunciation of some of the names of the racers, right? Yeah. We mispronounce names all the time, but we try to, like, we work hard to not do that. So we appreciate when people correct us and guide us in the right way, and try to just, I like to do a good job. I take my job very seriously in that regard. So I'm a studier. I spent a lot of hours preparing for it. And I hope that shows.
Oh, it does. It definitely does. And I know that now with like the YouTube, Facebook, Peacock thing, all the ways you're broadcasting this, there's a lot of enhanced features. So if people weren't watching these things yet online, can you tell us a little bit about some of the enhanced features that you're doing?
Yeah, for the Ironman World Championship, we had some great enhancements where you could choose your camera views. So we typically were streaming just one view, but viewers at home could select, you know, men's, if we were on sort of the men's chase pack, they could choose to continue to watch the men's leader, right? So they could watch, if they were a fan of whoever was leading the race, they could watch that camera, or, you know, have the transition camera, or just the leaderboard. So, you know, having multiple views and multiple options for the athletes for the fans to watch, I think was great. Some of the commentary that people are able to comment in, obviously on Facebook, they've always been able to comment in, but I think some of that enhanced chat features, so people can carry on conversations about, you know, the race, and we do try to police it for people that take it down the path that it doesn't need to go. But to really make the fans and the people watching at home, or even the people watching on the ground, like people are on their phones watching us, watching the race, and they'll comment in, like, we might not have a camera on so-and-so, but they just flatted and they're on the side of the road and someone comments on it. And so we're able to then, you know, send the camera back to say, hey, so-and-so is at mile X and this has just happened. So the interaction, I think, is fantastic and leads to the experience. You know, we want to do a better job, and there's a lot of things that we could do better and that we want to do better, but it ain't cheap. So, you know, we need to be mindful of budgets and the free coverage is something that we're proud of, and we could make it better, but it costs dollars. And so what we do with what we've got, I'm super proud of. And we hope to continue to make it better and better and make that experience better for the viewers to show these athletes and tell these stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I was really impressed with it. It was great to watch. I don't think I could let you go without asking you about the 2-day format. What was your impression of the 2-day format, and now with the idea of it moving men's and women's to different locations, what are your feelings on these things that are happening with the race?
I was a huge advocate of the two-day format because I believe that the women deserve to race their race on their day. Mm-hmm. Our ability to cover the women more thoroughly because we have greater resources to dedicate to the women. And then again, to the men, we covered more men because we didn't have to take two of the cameras and send them to the women's race. Right. Like, it's, we could show more with this 2-day format. So I think I'm a big fan of it because it gives the women's coverage, having a woman first across the line. And I know maybe that doesn't make sense if you're a man. You're like, why does that matter so much? But it matters for women's sport that a woman be the first one across the line. It matters.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I was a huge fan of the 2-day format. Obviously, I was concerned because I'm also deeply respectful of the community that we go to. And I thought, gosh, that's an awful lot of people and a lot of strain on a pretty small town with not a lot of roads, right? So obviously that was in the back of my mind. The fact that it hasn't worked out for both races to stay in Hawaii is incredibly heartbreaking. And when I heard about it, there is no elegant solution, right? It's a dreadful scenario, and it's not going to be great for everybody. And someone ultimately, with the decisions they had to make, someone's going to be disappointed.
Right.
I do hope in the long run that we find a community where both men and women can be in the same place and race in that 2-day format in the same place. Because I think dividing the men and women, we're a community, right? That's what's so great about our sport is the community of Ironman. And the fact that we saw the Norwegians out there cheering for the pro women and then the pro women out there cheering for, you know, the pro men and vice versa. I think to divide that detracts from our sport. So I do hope that eventually we find a community, whether it's back in Hawaii or whether it's somewhere else, where we can all be together, because I think we all need to be together. But for now, I love the fact that the women get to race their race without involvement from the men, be it age group men or pro men. And that same thing for the men, they get to race their race without the women. You know, all of those pro men don't have to worry about getting caught by Lucy Charles Barkley in the swim. They all sleep a little bit better, I think, not getting past, you know, being the second place woman out on the course when Lucy's out ahead of them on the bike. So I love the fact that the women have their own race. I hope that we can be together again one day in a single venue, because I think that's just what our sport deserves from a community standpoint. I'm also, it's hard because I also admire the history that Hawaii offers, you know, the inexorable link between Hawaii and the Ironman World Championship. Like I said, there's not a simple solution, and it's beyond my pay grade to make those decisions. So I'm a little heartbroken that we're not going to be together, but I like the idea that the women and the men have their own day and should be celebrated independently of one another, but we should do it collectively, if that makes sense.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And do you have any suggestion as to where they might be putting this second race?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay.
That's beyond my pay grade.
Not okay. is that I might know, but I'm not allowed to say, or I don't know? Don't know. Okay, we'll leave it at that. Sure. All right. Well, hey, Dee Dee, I want to thank you so much for coming and sharing your stories. I know everybody was really watching that Ultraman World Championship, and also everybody's watching that Ironman World Championship where you were commentating. So it's nice to have you here and to share some of that background and behind the scenes stuff and how the race actually unfolded for you and your training that led to it. So thanks for sharing everything that you did with me today.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. I mean, again, I'm a fan of the sport. So anybody that is willing to listen, I hope they hear my enthusiasm and my love. It's a special opportunity we have to get to do this crazy, sometimes stupid sport.
And if there's any people out there looking to get into Ultraman or that are in it and looking to improve and they just want to get some tips from a champion, is there a way they can reach out to you and ask a few questions?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm probably most responsive on Instagram. Yeah, I do respond to Facebook Messenger. I have a website and that has an email, but I'm dreadful about checking it. So if I'm sluggish to get back to you, maybe just ping me on Instagram and say, hey, check your website email. Yeah, I love interacting with people and answering questions and really taking the time. A lot of people were very patient and kind with me and answering my questions when I first got started in the sport. And I've had a lot of help get into this Ultraman world title. So I'm a big believer in paying it forward. So absolutely reach out. I'd love to be helpful to anybody that's looking for, you know, questions answered.
Unless they're in the 50 to 59 age group.
Well, no, go for it, man. Hey, I'm going to cheer. I'm absolutely going to cheer you on. I would steer clear. Like, don't ask me questions about astrophysics or anything like that, because I don't know that stuff. But anything triathlon related, absolutely. Light me up.
All right. Thanks once again.
Thank you.
Remember, this is a special two-part episode, so be sure to also download Part B to hear my conversation with the 2022 55 to 59 age group Ironman Women's World Champion, Yvonne Timewell, available in the library.
Hey, if you liked what you heard today, please tell a friend and be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We'd appreciate it if you'd rate and review the show while you're there. Drop the names of the people you think we should interview, and we'll get in touch with them and make that happen. Thank you for listening to 515, the Ultra Podcast, a production of 55 Enterprises. Now really, go subscribe now before you forget.